Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tech boot camps seem like a great deal. Learning coding or web design in just a few months and landing a well-paying job with a future seems like a no-brainer. But it's not that simple, and the promised careers don't always materialize. Emily Stewart is a senior correspondent at Vox. She writes about money and the economy, and she's been looking into the pros and cons of tech boot camps. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get a thumbnail definition here of a boot camp. What do we mean by this?
So boot camps, you know, we think about these short programs, really maybe a few months, that promise to teach you a specific skill in tech. So software design or data analytics or user experience. So these really short programs, they're pretty expensive a lot of the time, thousands of dollars that say, you do this in 3 months, 9 months, 6 months, and you get a job.
They've been popping up for a while now, right?
Yeah, these really started to hit, you know, after the financial crisis, when people were sort of looking for new paths, and you started to see all of these great jobs in Silicon Valley. We all sort of know this dream and this almost meme of these guys in sweatpants who play ping pong at work while they're at Google. It seems really attractive. And so these have been around for quite some time.
And is there, how do you look at the efficacy of them? Are they required to show graduation and job rates?
Well, so they're not accredited. And one of the big issues with them is that, you know, it's really difficult to tell kind of which one is which, what they are doing. Now, a lot of them do say we do X amount of job placement or our graduates have this path. The problem is that this is all self-reported and they can have some funky ways of reporting this. So sure, we have a 99% graduation rate, but hey, we didn't really, you know, include these people for different reasons, or we have an X percent job placement rate. But if you look at the fine print, a lot of our job placement is as teaching assistants with our own outfit for our graduates. So these people didn't get a job at Google or at Bloomberg or at Apple. They got a job with us.
Why is there? I mean, if they're not accredited, that means there's no regulation.
Yeah, and different states will have different regulations. One school that I looked at that's based in New York did get in trouble because they didn't have the correct licensing. But there isn't, it's not like a regular, you know, college that would, you would assume there would be certain standards. With these, there really isn't. And one person that I spoke to who used to be a recruiter at Google did tell me that the problem with these is that there are just so many of them and there isn't really a quality control. So people don't know what they're getting into. And it also, on the side of the employer, that means if they look and see somebody went to a boot camp, they don't necessarily know what skills they have because they don't know the quality of the boot camp.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've ever considered going to a tech boot camp, we're talking about that now with Emily Stewart. She's a senior correspondent at Vox. She writes about money and the economy, and she's been looking into the pros and cons of tech boot camps. Now, I would imagine one good first rule of thumb is to ask whether it's for profit or not for profit.
Right. And most of these are for profit, full stop. Most of these are for profit and most of them are very expensive. And you can take out loans to get into them or they are income sharing agreements, but yes, most of them are for profit. And it's a tough business model. A lot of them have also gone out of business.
When you talk about taking out loans, these aren't federally insured loans, are they?
A lot of them are just private loans, right? And personal loans, and people take out, like, this isn't the same as a student loan program generally. But what a lot of what these institutions do or programs is they do income sharing agreements, which sounds really nice. Basically, that's like, hey, you don't pay us anything up front, or maybe $3,000 up front, but once you get a job, we'll take 15-17% of your salary, which in theory sounds like, you know, we're all in this together. This only works for us if this works for you. Well, 15-17% of your salary is actually a lot of money. And I think sometimes people don't think about that ahead of time. But also, sometimes you think when you get into this, you're going to make six figures, but that's not what happens. So let's say you wind up in a job that's maybe just $60,000. That's a lot of money that they're taking from your paycheck. And so people wind up in these agreements that they don't really think about. Or sometimes these companies or these programs will force you to take any job that is quote unquote tech. And so any job can be tech, really, if you think about it. And so maybe your job isn't technically the job that you thought you were going to get, but they say it counts. And so they're taking your salary anyway.
Is the premise, setting the business model aside, is the premise of a tech boot camp legitimate in the first place? I mean, should you expect to achieve these goals they set out there for you?
I mean, I think it's a tough question to answer. It's understandable to want to do this.
Sure.
It's, working from home sounds really great. But if you think about it, I think take a step back. And to be honest, I hadn't thought about this a lot until someone mentioned it to me. The best that you can do in 3 months is cram. You're not actually learning a profession, especially something that's difficult. And a lot of the people I spoke to said, a lot of people don't actually like programming when they get into it. This isn't always the most fun job, and people don't realize that it's hard. It takes a long time. That after you do the boot camp, even if it does work for you, it may be really difficult to get a job. Once you do get that job, you might not have the same skills as everybody else. And I think it's really appealing to think I went in 3 months into a brand new career. But like I said before, I think once you take a step back and think about it, it's just, there's no way in that amount of time that you can actually get the skills that you would really, I think, need.
What are employers saying about boot camp grads?
It's difficult, and tech can be elitist, right? These companies also sometimes are just looking at whether you went to Stanford, which isn't great. And some people I talked to said companies have become a little bit more open on this front. But in general, they're not looking at a resume and saying, oh, you went to a tech boot camp, now you work at Amazon. It's just not how it works. And it's tricky. I spoke to one woman who said, listen, I was at Google for 13 years. And in that time, I knew of two people without a 4-year degree. And both of them were self-taught. And so I think at least if people go into this stuff, they need to be a little bit more realistic that it's not an impossible path, but it is a lot harder, and employers aren't necessarily sourcing from boot camps. Basically,
there's one in Columbus, it's called Color Coded, and it's a nonprofit, and it works with corporations hand in hand to get them the applicants they need to be trained in the way they need them to be trained. And the ultimate goal, obviously, is to diversify the tech workforce, right? I mean, there's a good reason for all of this. So how is one to suss out what's the good guy and what's not?
That's a tough, it's really tough. And some people I spoke with said, it's good to talk to alumni directly and say hey, how did this go? And not the person that the tech boot camp
gives you. Yeah.
Talk to somebody who really went there. There are, resources online, Course Report was a website that I looked at that has reviews. But it's also worth noting that they leave up everybody, every institution, including ones that have rebranded, let's say, because they've gotten into so much trouble. Some people I spoke with said, check out what your community college is offering, or the program that you just mentioned, that's a nonprofit, things like that, see what you can learn on your own. And I think just really, you need to dig in on the promises. A lot of these programs will say, oh, we have a partnership with X company. Well, what does that actually look like? Do they actually have a partnership? What does that mean when they say that they do? They have all these logos on their website. What does that mean? I spoke with one woman who had done a boot camp who said they were getting, the students and graduates were getting meetings with different companies, and at some point realized that none of these companies were hiring. They were just meetings to whatever, chat. And so those sorts of things, they require a lot of scrutiny, and it's tough to suss out.
You said that some have gotten in trouble. What kind of trouble do they get into?
Well, some of them have been sued by students. Some of them have been sued by attorneys general. And they get into trouble for all sorts of things. A lot of them will be, let's say, operating without the necessary licenses. That's what happened with one in New York. They were also making misleading employment and salary claims. And they had a settlement of a few $100,000. A lot of them will just really overstate, basically make kind of false promises and and defraud their students and stick them into situations where, like, hey, we told you you were definitely going to get a job, you didn't. And then, you know, they get in trouble for those sorts of promises. And especially, again, when you look at the fine print, a lot of these places are doing some very funky math in terms of how much money people are making and who they count and who they discount when they do their data.
How much is the cost of the boot camps wrapped up in the hardware?
No, I don't know. I really don't. I mean, that's one I do not know. Don't want to lie.
Let me ask you, is there an alternative? So somebody who doesn't have a lot of resources, doesn't have necessarily access to a traditional undergrad degree somewhere, forget about Stanford, just anywhere. Is there an alternative? Are you thinking community college? Are there legitimate alternatives for somebody who does want to get into tech? Because the fact of the matter is, there's a huge demand for tech workers.
Right. You know, some people I talked to did mention community college is a great place to look and start and just see what's up. Look for nonprofit programs, look for free online resources that exist. You know, a tough answer on this is that some people can be really successful learning it on their own. That's hard. Again, I don't think that, I think sometimes the hard answer here is that these are difficult jobs to get and some of these skills are very difficult. I don't know how to code. I can't imagine even beginning to learn how in any circumstance.
So it's harder than they're saying.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, if you think about it, it really is. It is difficult. And like, I had just never even in my life thought about it. I have a friend who's just now transitioned into user experience design and is having a genuinely hard time finding a job. It's difficult skills. And it's also, again, I think a few people that I spoke with who are programmers said, like, some people just don't like this. And that's an important thing to think about as well. You don't want to spend a bunch of money developing some sort of skill or whatever in something that you actually, when you get to do it, you don't enjoy it.
I mean, I like playing Minecraft, but there's no way I could translate that into a software design acumen.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's not for everyone.
Right. So, all right. So what is this, you know, you report about money in the economy. What does it say about our economy going forward if it's so revolving around tech, but we can't produce enough people to fill the jobs, at least at this point, and we can't seem to come up with a system of education that can do it in a legitimate, largely legitimate way?
You know, it's tough. And one person that I spoke with about this said, you know, a big problem here is that we don't quite know how to think about education and who's responsible for paying for education and who's responsible for educating our population. Like, we treat it as this personal thing that you should figure out what you want to do and then pay for it. But it benefits everyone when we have a well-trained workforce in tech and everywhere. And that's something that we really do need to grapple with more.
Have you thought about, or did anybody talk to you about starting in high school and starting coding in high school?
I mean, nobody talked to me about that, but it seemed like it would probably be a good idea.
To start training them, and at least everyone should have some sort of rudimentary, that and media literacy, some sort of rudimentary knowledge to go, yes, before they go forth in our society in the future.
Yes, and maybe some financial.
Yes, some financial,
well.
Right. Emily Stewart, thanks a lot for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Emily Stewart is a senior correspondent at Vox. She writes about money and the economy. She's been looking into the pros and cons of tech boot camps. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The overturn of Roe v. Wade has created new reasons to care about online privacy. In a world where abortions could be criminalized, a Google search for a reproductive health clinic, an online order for morning after pills, or location data placing you at a physician's office could be used as evidence of a crime. But there are steps you can take to protect your privacy. Jeffrey Fowler is a technology columnist for The Washington Post. He examines how our technology fails us and the ideas to fix it. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann.
So, Jeffrey, there are some obvious ways someone could gather data about your reproductive health care choices, like a Google search or from your location data. And then there are some less obvious ones like period tracking apps. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important message here is everything you do is being tracked. And I know we've talked about this on your show before, and maybe I sound like a broken record sometimes, but what the overturn of Roe versus Wade reminds us is that this is not just an issue of whether or not you get annoying ads that follow you around the internet. Losing privacy on the internet is a civil rights concern as well. And for, you know, many Americans who might now want to seek abortion and have to do so in private, or else they risk being prosecuted. You know, these are very real concerns. And keeping track of all of the places on your phone alone that might have information about your effort to seek an abortion or where you were going is really a huge undertaking. And there's just so many places on your phone that might have information about it. So you mentioned a couple. You mentioned Google searches for information. You mentioned, we ought to be talking about text messages mm-hmm. that you might send to other people that could be read. Then there's also things like period tracking apps, which many women use to track their reproductive cycles. That information too, contains really important clues about someone's reproductive health. And the thing I think people often forget is anytime a company collects information about you, the government can demand to get their hands on that information. It just takes a court order, or sometimes even less, for a company to hand over that information. So you really have to think about everything that goes on with your phone as could potentially going into the hands of the government.
And this isn't just about people who are seeking an abortion. This could be, if you live in Texas, it could be anybody who's helping them or engaged in any way with helping them. Maybe I'm the person that drives somebody to an abortion clinic. They could use the tracking data on my phone.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned a moment ago that the government can try to get its hands on any data a company collects, but increasingly, actually, the data broker industry just sells this data, which means it could sell it to the police, or it can sell it to vigilante groups or organizations that want to try to embarrass or publicly shame or call out people who might be seeking abortion. So the data is kind of going everywhere, and we don't really have laws in the U.S. that stop this.
Right. I mean, we don't have laws that stop anything like that, regardless of what the topic is, right?
Well, so America does have a health privacy law.
That's
called
right.
HIPAA.
I always forget about HIPAA.
Yeah. Well, you know, and people think that HIPAA, you know, people who are aware of HIPAA think it might protect you and this kind of information. But in fact, it doesn't. HIPAA was written in the 90s, back when health information was, you know, stored on printouts or handwritten charts that were kept in a basement somewhere. And now, of course, it's all digital. And HIPAA only applies to your relationship directly with your doctor, not to all of these other services, not to Google, not to Google Maps, not to your period tracking app. So it really is all out there.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about how your data on your phone could be used against you. And in the era of Dobbs, where Roe v. Wade has been overturned, abortions could be criminalized, and a Google search for a reproductive health clinic could be used as evidence against you or a person who helps you find or get to an abortion. My guest is Jeffrey Fowler. He is a technology columnist for The Washington Post. He examines how our technology fails us and the ideas to fix it. So, Jeffrey, even the seemingly simple apps that we download without thinking about it can harvest and sell our data. That's why technically usually why they're free or very low cost to us. Mm-hmm. But there's three major categories of data that could be used against women seeking abortions. Can we go over how they could be used and what one can do to protect oneself, starting with location data?
Yeah, location data is really one of the big ones. You know, we use maps on our phones to, you know, help us figure out where to go, to look up places. And that's one part of the data that's collected. I think a lot of people don't realize this, but Google Maps in particular sort of nudges you to allow it to keep a history of where you go, not just the places you search, it does that too, but also the places you physically go because it's tracking your location in the background. And, you know, again, Google could hand that over if they are asked to. So it's smart to turn that off. But there are other ways that your location is being tracked as well. So your cell phone carrier keeps information about where you're going. And there is no real way to turn that off unless you also turn off your phone or turn off the signals coming out of your phone. Then there are lots of other apps out there that you don't really think about, but once upon a time, they asked for your location and you said yes. And now all of a sudden they might be collecting it all the time, or maybe even then selling that information to other companies who then sell it on to even other people. So, you know, if you are in a situation where you need to go to a clinic and see a doctor, and you need to do that in private, you might seriously want to think about, at the very least, switching off location services on your phone before you head out. There's usually a master toggle on the phone for that. Now it means that certain apps like Uber and Lyft won't work, but it would keep, you know, the stuff on your phone from collecting your location. If you're really worried about your cell phone carrier too, you know, you might need a burner phone or just some, you know, just turn off your phone entirely when you're off on that visit.
But that's one visit, but there's the search and chat histories, which, I mean, we all get our Googler out every time we have a question about what to eat for dinner tonight, let alone these kinds of things. How do you address those?
Yeah, this is really a big one. And it really kind of underscores something that I think is a bigger conversation that we're having as a society. You know, Google is kind of the main example of, you know, it's one of the darlings of Silicon Valley, and it's gotten so big based on the premise that it can just wildly collect and keep anything that it can learn about us. And so that includes everything that you search for. You know, by default, Google keeps all of your searches in Maps and in search and all the different services it has for at least 18 months. And some people may have their settings inadvertently turned on to let them keep it forever. And again, all of that could be turned over. So that's a big thing. Messaging is also another one. You know, a lot of people just use plain old fashioned text messages on their phone. All of that is kind of open and could be grabbed. So if you want to be safer with your messaging, go for one of these secure end-to-end encrypted messaging programs. So what that means is that that only you and the person you're communicating with can see and unlock the messages. So that would keep a company like Google from handing it over, even if they did get a note from a judge. So you know, those services include things like Signal, even iMessage on the iPhone is pretty good about that. But if you're going to use one of those, remember, whatever your phone knows, the thing in your hand, you know, if someone gets access to your phone, they can see the whole thing. So make sure your phone has a good password put on it, you know, or one of those codes that can't be unlocked. Use your fingerprint or whatever it is, but don't go around without it being locked, because then anybody who gets it can get the information on it.
Okay, so I just went to my settings and I you know, clicked on Google and I went there and I do see it does talk about my location and I have it clicked on while using the app.
Yep, that means that whenever you've got the Google Maps app, is that the app you're talking about?
No, it's just Google.
Oh. and you might want to turn that off.
Should I put it to never? then just ask next time when I share or never.
You know,
I mean, I don't know. How are people supposed to know what to do?
I know. Well, two thoughts. One, when in doubt, say no.
Okay.
What's the worst thing that's going to happen to you? If it really needs it, it'll ask you to type in your address or something. So when in doubt, say no. Okay. I agree with you. The whole system that we've got in America right now for dealing with this stuff puts so much work on our shoulders as patients, as parents, as workers, and it's really stacked against us and in favor instead of these big corporations. And so that's something we need to change. If you want some advice, we produce a lot of it at the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. So my team called Help Desk put out a really kind of a comprehensive guide of all of the different things you might need to think about if you're trying to seek an abortion in private or seek information about abortions in private. That's on our website right now. Beyond that, we have a whole guide called the Privacy Reset Guide. And we just kind of go through all the big apps and things on your phone and tell you what are all of the terrible default settings, like that one that you had on your Google app just there.
It's changed.
That you should change right now if you really want to protect your information. Because the big picture here is, like, the whole industry is just collecting too much data about us. And we keep getting reminders that the more information they have, the more at risk different aspects of our lives can be that we can't imagine, can't fathom in the moment that the data is collected. So the safe approach is just collect less data.
The reproductive health apps, you mentioned the period, whatever they call it, tracker.
Period tracking.
Yeah, yeah, period tracking. What else is there? I mean, what are we talking about here? Like basal thermometer type stuff or?
Well, yeah, it's a good point. So first of all, there are a lot of different period tracking apps out there and they are very popular. You know, millions and millions and millions of women use them. And they have wildly different privacy practices. And so, you know, unless you're, you know, the kind of person who has time to really dig into what they're actually doing, you know, if you're in a state where you might need to seek an abortion in private, you really might want to consider just stopping using one of them. And instead, you know, use a piece of paper or notepad or
like
something
the old fashioned ways,
the old fashioned ways. Because it's really hard to know, you know, how protected that information is going to be at this point. I mean, since the attention has landed on this, I mean, even Nancy Pelosi put out a statement about period tracking apps yesterday. You know, some of these apps have tried to get some attention by saying that they're going to encrypt their data or protect it in new ways. And, you know, that's good. There should be a race to the top for better privacy. But, you know, again, it requires a fair amount of investigation when you choose one. So if you're not sure, just don't use it. But to your earlier point, yeah, there's lots of other information about our bodies that gets collected in places too. If you've got a smartwatch that might know other things about you, might know your temperature, might know other kinds of things, you know, make sure that that information is being stored in a place that's secure and just only you can access it with a password or passcode that you know. Apple is actually pretty good about this. So if you've got like an Apple Watch, that data is saved to the health account on your phone or the health app on your phone. And Apple can't access that. Only you can, which means that it's better protected.
Advocates have called on tech companies to delete information related to reproductive health and to collect less of it in general. Any sense about whether companies will a hue to that call?
That is the big question of the week. I mean, we've been hearing a lot of these companies, which are, you know, some of America's biggest employers, sort of do some virtue signaling around this issue and say, oh, we're going to pay for our employees to get access to reproductive care if they need to go to a different state or whatnot. But we really haven't heard them make any affirmative statements about, you know what, we're going to deal with this by collecting less information or by pushing back against, you know, judges' orders in new kinds of ways. They've really remained silent on this. Now, you know, whether that's because they're working behind the scenes or they fear if they say something, it, you know, will run afoul of a judge, who knows? But it is distressing that I haven't seen yet any changes in products, in the big ones, in Google, and you name it, in terms of the information that they're collecting. For example, Google could just make it a default that anytime somebody searches for information about sexual health or reproductive health of any type, when it sees those keywords in the search box, it just deletes those entries from your history, from your account. That is something it could do today if it wanted to, and so far it has not.
And by the way, I mean, anti-abortion activist groups have used phone location data to target ads to people thinking about getting an abortion, right? I mean, this is a real thing. It's actually happening.
Yeah, this is a good point. And so Already, we have seen location data that is, again, available via the advertising industry used to target people who are seeking abortions, who are physically located inside a clinic. That happened in Massachusetts. Another thing to know has already happened is there's already precedent for using data from phones or from Google or from any of these companies to prosecute crimes, across lots of different kinds of crimes, but also particularly reproductive health crimes. You know, there have been cases that we've seen where women have been accused of killing a fetus, you know, and it was unclear whether it was, you know, whether it was intentional or whether it was a miscarriage. And courts and judges have sought, you know, Google search histories and text messages to see if there was some kind of intention there. So there is precedent for this happening.
And Google complied.
I am not a law professor, okay. So forgive me on this one, but I'm pretty sure that they did because we know about it.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, Jeffrey Fowler, thanks a lot for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Stay safe out there. And when in doubt, say no.
Okay. Jeffrey Fowler is a technology columnist for The Washington Post. He examines how our technology fails us and the ideas to fix it. We'll have a link to his column at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. With subscriber growth slowing and even reversing in some cases, streaming platforms are having to think of new ways to convince people to sign up. Netflix and Disney Plus have settled on launching a cheaper ad-supported subscription, which they both plan to do later this year. Here to tell us more is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Ads, are we going backwards?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, so there's a couple things to consider here. One is that everything is a streaming service now. You know, you think about all the different services that have different streaming apps that are available, and the average household has anywhere between 2 and 4 of those services, depending on, you know, kind of whether they have a cable subscription to go with it and things like that. So that's not a lot when you have 4 services and then, you know, kind of the big hitters that were offering like the 1 year free, you know, from Disney and from Apple and places like that are starting to expire. A lot of folks, especially now with everything being a little more expensive, including streaming services, have to start making some decisions. And we learned from the financial report a couple weeks ago that a lot of people decided that Netflix wasn't necessarily the thing that they needed to pay for year round, and that they could instead just pay for it when a show that they liked was out and kind of attached. They didn't have that they weren't using it every single day like they were when it first came out. So with a lot of people dropping subscriptions in favor of services that they use more often, these advertising models are making a little bit of a comeback. And Netflix has been kind of teasing this idea for almost a year now, and now it's finally become clear that that's something we will see later this year.
I'm sure advertising companies, you know, agencies are thrilled about this, but did they consider or bandy about, like, the idea of making it more affordable for people who stick with it versus people who jump on and off the stream?
No, I mean, you know, you would think that rolling out some kind of service where you could pay for a full year and have it be a little cheaper than what you would get if you paid month to month is also something that several other competitors offer. But no, that's not something that Netflix has ever put on the table. And when it comes to advertising, you know, Netflix has always had some kind of partnership outside of its streaming service as far as advertising things. It's worked really closely with a ton of different companies on Stranger Things merch, especially this year. Mm-hmm. You walk into Walmart or Target or something like that, and you see a ton of Stranger Things stuff all over the place. So it's kind of an easy target to see that happening in reverse. You know, the next season of Stranger Things, should that happen, might have some direct advertising inside of it from some of these other partners. And the same goes for other TV shows. The big thing here is that TV shows fueled largely by the work that has been done by Apple and HBO and Disney are becoming a lot more expensive in order to make those kind of high budget, you know, extremely visual shows. In order to keep up with all of those things, that the services themselves had to become more expensive. But yeah, it's interesting that an annual subscription, kind of lock-in was never something that Netflix offered up.
What do you think about this? Do you think this is going to be supported or popular, I suppose, is another word?
I think it's going to depend a whole lot on what the actual discount is. You know, if Netflix is only dropping, say, $4 or $5 off of the deal in order to have the service, I think what they'll probably see is people who weren't using the service super often and were already kind of on the fence about canceling, trying this cheaper service instead of people kind of flocking back to the service. I think that there are a lot of people right now who are making decisions based on the shows that they're actually watching. And I'm definitely one of those people. You know, I have a Paramount Plus subscription because I love the new Star Trek series. But as soon as that show is over, I'm probably going to drop it until something else that's interesting comes along. I think it's just, it's a lot less common right now for folks to just pay for something all the time, even when they're not using it.
Do you think some platforms, that it won't work as well for some platforms?
I think some of the shows, some of the services that have kind of less regular heavy hitters, like the, you know, Paramount Plus that I just mm-hmm. you know, mentioned, Apple's probably another one where, if Apple TV isn't something that you're using every single day, then you're probably only going to pick up a month of service when a new show comes out. You know, I know a lot of people who dropped Apple TV as soon as the most recent season of Ted Lasso ended, and probably aren't going to come back until the next season starts. So I think it's going to depend a lot like that. You know, Disney works really hard for Disney Plus to make sure that there's kind of always something new happening that reaches a pretty broad audience. Plus there's just a ton of kid-friendly stuff on Disney Plus that Netflix doesn't quite have the competing grip with. Amazon Prime Video is another one, where the service is included with Amazon Prime, so it's a little less easier to kind of notice that you're paying for it as part of the service. And I think that if it were separated, it would probably be something that people didn't use quite as often.
This all sounds like a lot of work, which is kind of what they're counting on, right? They're counting on most people are not like Russell Holley. They aren't going to be as vigilant.
I mean, that's the whole subscription model in a nutshell is people sign up and they do the thing. And then, it carries over, you know, you pay that monthly and you don't, you don't cancel. But to combat that, there's a ton of services that are available right now that are financial help services. And some of them are actually built into bank services now that say, hey, these are your monthlies. Are you sure that you're actually using these services? And if not, you want to press this button and we'll show you how to cancel it. I think that those have become quite popular in the last couple of years. In particular, you know, this past year, I've seen a lot of those companies have started advertising instead of just kind of having the service available. So I think that the days of those kind of zombie subscriptions hanging out in your bank account are probably pretty close to at an end, depending on, you know, kind of where you live and what your bank account looks like.
When it comes to Apple, do you see if we talk about ads on Apple, are you talking about Apple ads? Like they'll be advertising their own product or what?
Yeah, this is tough because Apple doesn't really have that kind of relationship with much of anything as far as its advertisers go. And the moment that Apple has ads on its platform for things that aren't Apple products, that kind of consumer data necessary in order to provide the best advertising really goes against the privacy policies that Apple has set up over the last couple of years. Apple hasn't gone that route yet. Instead, they're relying on kind of that quality of service or bundling it with other things. You know, if you're an iCloud user, you pay an extra $2 and you get Apple TV plus to go along with it. The bundling of services is something that Apple has seen a lot of success with. And, you know, that kind of slow rollout of these higher quality services seem to be working pretty well for the company so far.
Okay, we'll stand by for that. Riot Games is going to start monitoring players' voice communications in its free-to-play game, Valorant, on July 13th. All right, Riot Games is a game company, right? A gaming company.
That's right.
Valorant is probably one of its more popular games, I would assume.
Absolutely. Valorant is definitely its most popular game right now, as far as, you know, that kind of online, folks playing for a couple hours a night with friends, and the voice chat is a big part of that game. You know, being able to communicate with your teammates, be it positive or negative, is often a big part of the game experience there.
I'm kind of creeped out by this. Why do they want to do this?
So this is an anti-harassment tool, according to Riot. The thing that they're building right now is, there are a lot of people, my daughter being one of them, actually, who play Valorant and have pretty negative experiences every once in a while, where someone on the team doesn't like how they're playing or doesn't like their accent. And in the process of playing will actually be quite nasty in the voice chat. And that's not documented anywhere. It's not like Xbox Live in 10 years ago, where you're sending someone a message saying, hey, you're not very good at this game, or, you know, you're kind of being verbally abusive there. These messages in those real-time chat systems aren't recorded anywhere. So if you, as the person who was really not satisfied with that game experience, you felt like you were being harassed by the people you were playing with, go to report that offensive comment, be it a racial slur or, you know, just kind of general nastiness, there's not really a lot that the folks at Riot can do, because there's no record of it happening. Now, if multiple people have reported the same person for this behavior, then you know, kind of action can be taken. The goal here from Riot's perspective is to capture this voice data in a way that makes it so that they can start assessing these player reports and make sure that people who are just being downright nasty on some of these online games aren't able to come back and play.
So player reports, how does that work? How do you do that?
Yeah, so when you play an online game with someone, there's kind of a record of the people who were on your team and who were the people that you were playing against. And when you get to the end of a game, there's a report function built into the service where you can actually go back in and you can find that person. And there are a list of reasons that you can report someone for playing. You know, either they were, you know, cheating in the game, or like I said, there's this kind of verbal harassment that happens. And those reports are sent to the folks at Riot to analyze and deal with.
Would Riot be concerned about just somebody dissing somebody's playing, or are we talking about, are they more concerned about hate speech, harassment, things like that?
It's definitely that second part. You know, okay. If someone's just, you know, being kind of a bully, like that's not great. But the big thing there is, you know, there are a ton of online reports. You know, there are folks who record themselves when they're streaming on Twitch or YouTube or things like that. And the moment that certain players hear someone with an accent, you know, the kind of nastiness comes out, you know, especially if they don't feel like they're very good at the game or something like that. And that goes, you know, especially true if the person playing in what is typically a male dominated game is a woman. You know, so that experience, you know, kind of carries through to a lot of games. Is definitely not just Valorant, but being able to actually hear from that player's mouth what's being said makes a significant difference in being able to remove them from the platform if necessary.
And so when you're talking about accents, you're talking about people who are from other countries or in other countries playing.
I mean, not just other countries. There are definitely a couple of folks who are unkind to people who have Southern drawl, you know, maybe accusing them of being slow in the game and you know, maybe not understanding how the game gets played. It's it turns out that that kids don't need a whole lot of reasons to be mean to other people.
They never have.
And online gameplay when they're in kind of an unmonitored environment is a great way for that to foster into something not great.
Do you see this creating a trend? Do you see a trend forming behind this?
I think Valorant is an incredibly popular game, and Riot is fairly new in taking this approach. There are not a lot of other companies that that do exactly this. If this shows some kind of demonstrable success, I would definitely say that we would see other online organizations, you know, kind of pick this up and try to go. The biggest place that this would be just kind of a massive step towards, you know, being nice online would be Xbox Live. It's the biggest, you know, kind of online gaming platform for this kind of thing. But this is a a potential small step towards something that could be tremendously positive for people playing games online.
So they're going to use the data from the recordings to train their language models that'll be eventually, you know, then they'll set them free to evaluate player reports across all their games. Could the data be used for things other than training language models? Could it become data that could be searchable by law enforcement for some reason?
For the moment, the privacy policy that was updated in order to reflect this information is very specific about what this information is used for. And you know, police reporting and things like that are not a part of it. Neither is advertising. This is very specifically, if you read the privacy policy, for, you know, kind of hate speech and harassment and things like that. However, Riot made this privacy policy change on July. About a week and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where you log in and there's a little button that says, hey, the privacy policy changed, and you can push a button to read the privacy policy change, or you can just press another button to go into the game. So there's, you know, there's nothing saying that Riot couldn't change the privacy policy again to be something where that voice data could be used for other things.
I mean, I guess the idea is that if people know they're being recorded, they might clean up their act.
I mean, that is certainly true of a lot of other online games. You know, when it became clear that you couldn't just send someone a direct message that, you know, insulted them in Xbox Live, then that, you know, kind of dropped a lot. And, you know, so that's certainly the hope here, is that by being very vocal about how this is going to work and when this tool is finally available for the folks at Riot to use, the hope is that this will see a pretty dramatic drop in how many negative reports you see in games like this, but only time will tell.
And as far as Valorant goes, is this mostly something that younger people use, or is it all ages?
I would say it's all ages. It definitely skews a little more towards teens than, let's say, you know, gamers in their 30s and 40s, but there are definitely a pretty wide variety of people who play the game.
Hey, I need to ask you, is there a game out there that's connected to Stranger Things?
Not in this sense. You know, there are Stranger Things games that you can play on your phone, but not in like a multiplayer or online environment.
Do you anticipate? I mean, have you watched it? It just feels like it's a gaming format now.
I think, you know, the cool thing about Stranger Things is that it's this kind of deeply creepy, seedy, you know, kind of thing where you could very much see kind of a solo, almost horror game where you're kind of walking around solving a mystery.
Yeah.
In that universe, I think that would be very exciting. And you know, now that Netflix is actually putting games on its streaming platform, that may be a direction it decides to go if the show doesn't pick up another season.
You wanted to talk about Samsung and Starbucks. They're teaming up to release phone accessories.
So, yes, Starbucks has always been sort of music adjacent. You know, it started very early in the days of Starbucks. You were able to buy the albums of the music that was played in the store. And then when they stopped doing physical discs, there were Spotify streams that you could pick up for the stuff that you heard in the stores, and that it became possible to do a lot of other things there. This is the first time that a phone company has worked specifically with Starbucks to kind of continue that music tradition. And the goal here was a series of accessories. Some of them are deeply, deeply silly, in my opinion. Like, there is a case that you can get for a Samsung Galaxy phone where it has this kind of tether on the back to make it easier to hold the phone that looks like your favorite Starbucks order receipt on the back of the case. And that is, you should probably not drink Starbucks quite that often if you feel the need to broadcast your receipt on the back of your phone, but who am I to judge? The other is a very tiny looking Starbucks coffee cup that has a very lovely piece of latte art on top that features Samsung's Galaxy Buds too, you know, the earphones that are already out. There are a couple different cases and designs that go into this product line. It is not, you know, the cases are obviously just for Samsung phones, but the headphones can be used with pretty much anything. And I doubt that Samsung was ever going to get a deal like this with another coffee shop, in very much the same way that I doubt that Starbucks was going to find a deal with Apple in order to do something similar to this. So this is really kind of a group here where these two companies found kind of a unique way to partner up for this. And it's definitely not my thing, but I imagine that there are quite a few Starbucks fans who are going to be very excited about some of these accessories.
Russell Holly, thanks for your time as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's managing editor for commerce at CNET. And that is it for Tech Tuesday today. You can check us out on Facebook. You can follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.